talking a bit about the physical science basis for climate change and some of the anticipated health effects. I'll also be discussing a recent initiative that CDC has begun, engaging both internally and externally partners in response to climate change. And I'd like to wrap up with some of the core priority areas that CDC has identified through this process and give you a sense of where we might be headed as we as a public health organization confront the challenges of climate change. So some recent observations on climate change indicate that there are a number of physical processes that are changing in our globe, including global mean temperature, which has been increasing quite dramatically as of late, and in addition, sea levels rising as a result of polar ice melting, as well as glacial runoff, and northern hemisphere snow cover is also decreasing quite rapidly. These are trends that have been observed for a while, but as of this spring, have reached almost a unanimous scientific consensus. Some of those impacts of these climate changes that have already begun indicate that heat waves and heavy precipitation events are very likely to become more frequent. It's also likely that tropical cyclones will become more intense with larger peak wind speeds and heavier precipitation, which are some of the most critical aspects of these types of storms as they impact human health. So in regards to these climate changes, including temperature, sea level rise, and increase in hydrologic extremes, we can anticipate a number of outcomes, including those direct impacts of climate change, which include extreme heat waves and more severe heat events, severe weather events, which result most commonly in injuries and direct fatalities, an exacerbation of air pollution as a result of the interaction between heat and the urban form, as well as some secondary effects such as changes in ecology, which will affect the spread of vector-borne diseases, the productions of aeroallergens, and the suitable environments for the spread of some waterborne diseases. Also, tertiary effects we can expect would also include mental health outcomes of dealing with the consequences of climate change being affected by disaster, but also living in an environment where we have to think about the gloomy outlook for our future climate. Environmental refugees can expect to escalate the amount of civil conflict, both within countries as well as between borders in many parts of the world. This is a very significant stressor on human society. One important point about the effects of climate change that we are certain is that the burden of these health effects will not be equally distributed. Most interestingly, despite the number of organizations, the amount of initiatives that have confronted climate change, both from a physical and social, physical science and a social science basis, and the high degree of likelihood that these climate changes will result in adverse health effects, public health really has yet to step up to the plate and address many of these fundamental challenges. This is one thing we realized within the past few years and have convened a number of workshops to set the stage and a future direction for the public health response to climate change and understand what role can climate change or can public health have at that table. I'm a member of the Climate Change Science Program, which is the U.S. government's interagency cooperative structure that deals with addressing the physical science basis of climate change. And a recent report by the National Research Council to the CCSP identified some glaring deficiencies in our activities, which include addressing the social basis of climate change, what impact these will have on communities, what types of adaptations communities need to develop in response to this. But most fundamentally and most worrying to us is that the public health aspect has largely been left out of the equation. I have been attending a number of these meetings over the past year or two, and my role as a public health person at these climate change meetings is often met with surprise, which is another indication of the amount of room ground that we need to catch up with in order to address some of these stressors. We find a lot of people from the energy sector, from the agriculture sector, who've been engaged in this topic for a while. And this quote from our director, Dr. Gerberding, just reiterates that, that we understand that there are going to be negative health consequences of climate change. We do have systems in place that can address these. They do need to be bolstered. We need to take a fundamental approach to addressing these health effects. And as she said, we're just at the very beginning of this. But we've convened on climate change and health consequences, on the climate change and health consequences, and we are at the table. And I think public health in general is very much at this stage where it's time to take the next step and start engaging policymakers, decision makers, not just to change the dialogue, not just from a dialogue about how peak oil is going to affect our economy or how agricultural production is going to be affected by climate change, but that this is a fundamentally a public health issue that we need to address. Towards this public health framework for addressing climate change, I'd like to introduce a number of principles that we feel are fundamental to our direction forward. These are both practical and ethical principles that we see as our guiding signposts to developing a policy and addressing some of these effects, and they include the fundamental approach of public health in this prevention framework. Also, the concept of co-benefits and synergies that and I'll describe go into detail about these, but then the changes that we make that affect public health will also have other co-benefits for other sectors of society. I'm going to discuss the precautionary principle and concepts of environmental justice, as well as breaking out of the host pathogen model towards a more complex view of how health is situated in the environment. The first one I want to talk about is the public health prevention framework, which differentiates between primary prevention and secondary and tertiary prevention. When we talk about climate change, the dialogue there is dichotomized between mitigating, which is efforts to slow or stabilize the production or the effects of greenhouse gases, and adaptation, which is dealing with those consequences. And much of the science tells us now that we've already passed the point in which mitigation is going to have any impact upon short-term and mid-range consequences. We certainly have to engage in the concept of mitigation, in that now's the time to act to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But from a public health standpoint, our task squarely lies within the concept of adaptation, and that we must prepare for and respond to these associated health effects of climate change. However, public health can ignore entirely the concept of primary prevention and mitigation, and that we need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in our own operations. I feel terrible every time I get on a plane two or three times, four times a month to talk about climate change. And as I was talking to Ed, we have a series of workshops that we're convening experts to discuss these concepts, and we are purchasing carbon offsets. It makes us feel great that we can purchase an offset for a pound of CO2, but that's in some sense the wrong message, because we're still producing that pound of ton of CO2. But we have an obligation, or also we're in a good position to assess the health implications of various mitigation strategies. What will increasing the albedo or reflective capacity of cities do to ocular cancer or a number of other health outcomes? What would be the health effects of some of these strategies that we want to engage in with regards to mitigation? And we have an opportunity to educate both public and policymakers on the health effects, the health benefits of those mitigation strategies by building schools closer to neighborhoods and getting people to walk to schools, or building transportation infrastructure. What will the corresponding health benefits be? So we can take this from a two-pronged approach. But the adaptation framework with regards to climate change is squarely within the range of our capacity as we currently have. And this includes our capacity to monitor the health effects and track the health outcomes of climate change, enhance emergency response capacity, and to understand how community vulnerabilities play out in severe weather events, and work towards weatherizing communities and building resiliency within those communities. Another principle I'd like to discuss is the precautionary principle, and it's one that is central to moving forward in in an environment of uncertainty. Much of the criticism of climate change centers on the uncertainty in the climate models, and any model that tries to predict future outcomes is going to have uncertainty in it, and we cannot let that get in the way of action. That the precautionary principle tells us if there is a credible credible threat to human health, we must take action now. We cannot be paralyzed by skeptics who critique the models on the basis of subtleties. That if there is a credible threat, we must respond to it, and that's the approach we do take. The co-benefits and synergies again empower us to step into fields or step into arenas where public health can have can receive positive benefits from, say, transportation infrastructure or the reduction in dependency on non-renewable energy. We can, if we understand some of those benefits, such as increasing community social capital and community contact through weatherizing plans such as heat wave buddy systems that get people into contact with each other, that let people talk to their neighbors, we can increase number of social contacts between people, which has been shown to be a measure of community resiliency to disruptions. By reducing vehicular traffic, we can reduce the numbers of injuries and as well air pollution. Increasing fuel efficiencies in cars, again, will have the subsequent impact on respiratory disease related to air pollution. So on and so forth. By identifying these as low-hanging fruit, we can inform public policy and get it moving forward in the framework of public health. Climate change will certainly affect those least capable of responding to it. One thing we know about natural disasters is that they affect the most vulnerable members of our society. And this cartogram, which shows a relative proportion of a specific variable, I don't know if you've seen these before. There's I should put the attribution on here. It's worldmapper.com, which is a fascinating website, which shows in a visual format the relative weight of specific variables. And one thing we know is that the United States emits a quarter of those greenhouse gases. However, one outcome of climate change is natural disasters, and we can see that the populations that are affected by those are clearly not in the developed world, meaning those who are most affected are least responsible for the greenhouse gas emissions that actually cause the problem. This is an ethical situation. This is something that public health and other sectors of society need to understand, that we have an ethical obligation to provide support to these communities that are going to be disproportionately affected by our activities. And this is not exclusively global, a global phenomenon. This affects those in our country as well, especially those who, for example, in Katrina, were displaced from their homes. And not only are they vulnerable because they don't have the opportunity to get out, but when they come back, nothing's left. 25% of renters have renters insurances. It's just one measure of vulnerability, but these are folks that live very close to the edge, and we must understand that and build that into our programs to address the health effects of climate change. Those with air conditioning, those with houses built on stilts, we're not terribly worried about, but those in the lower ninth ward, we certainly should be. Another principle that I'd like to introduce, you know, when we talk about climate change, is the idea of complexity and ecosystem thinking, and that these health effects are not situated in a vacuum, that all of these are just a few examples of a number of interacting elements that feed into both vulnerability and exposure when we talk about climate change. And it's going to require an integrative ecosystems approach to understand how do we adapt, and how certain outcomes will affect public's health, both in mental health, all the way down to chronic diseases, and how those all interact to both heighten vulnerability as well as enhance our ability to respond. So within this framework, I mentioned that we met in January of 2007 with a number of experts, including Dr. Maybach, to develop a set of priorities that the CDC and the public health community needed to engage with and needed to address for a way forward for establishing our approach to public health. And those set of priorities I'm going to present right now. If you're interested, our website on climate change, which is very new and it has a few pages on it, this policy, priority actions and a policy statement on climate change can be found on the web if you want to refer to it in the future. But the first one that public health needs to develop is its role, and this is not just CDC, this is a public health institution, state and local, as well as international organizations, is to serve as a credible resource for information on the health consequences of climate change. Surveillance is a fundamental aspect of all public health, and data on environmental exposures and conditions resulting from that often are found in disparate places. There's an initiative begun at the National Center for Environmental Health to expand and enhance current surveillance capacities by integrating multiple data sources, including environmental exposures, environmental health outcomes, infectious disease information, and develop a series of indicators that can help us track the changes in prevalence of these variables over time. The Environmental Public Health Tracking Program is one potential model for identifying these indicator variables and tracking them over time, bringing multiple data sources together to understand the impact that climate has on these very complex patterns. That is a fundamental challenge that climate change is going to put on public health, that we need to understand and integrate multiple data streams in a cohesive manner. Modeling and forecasting health effects does become critical because many of the outcomes we are concerned about are acute events, events that are sporadic in nature, and events that can be mitigated through accurate forecasting. If we understand well how cities will respond to specific events, both heavy rainfall, heat waves, tornadoes, etc., we can certainly increase our capacity to prepare for it. A great example of this is work that we are conducting in Phoenix with the Urban Center for Climate and Energy in understanding the role of the urban environment, how the urban heat island effect, this is a sketch of it on the upper right, and how that plays in with the incidence of heat-related deaths and heat-related illnesses. The image on the left is a nighttime thermal image of Phoenix that is one part of the models that we use to understand the relation between the urban environment and the distribution of these medical incidents. This is a picture of nighttime surface temperature in Phoenix. Again, you can see the city is retains a lot of heat at night, which is another feature of heat waves, is that the high nighttime minimums are quite lethal. Much in the same line, we have to provide, we have to enhance the science basis on the relationship between climate and health outcomes by sponsoring extramural research, by engaging academic partners who have the expertise in a wide variety of disciplines in order to understand the complexity, in order to develop capacity that is found in many different locations. I mentioned National Center of Excellence in Urban Climate and Energy, and this is a very interdisciplinary group of engineers and demographers and physicians, public health experts that develop models for the effects of specific, say, weather events or air pollution events on the urban forum, and to develop ways of understanding how those might change in the future. One outcome of these models is to identify specifically which of those populations, locations, and groups are at greatest risk. By understanding the epidemiology of something like heat waves, we know that the elderly, those that are on specific medications, or those with diabetes, obesity, etc., are greatest at risk. But we need to know where those people are and where in cities they reside. A heat wave alert over a city the size of Phoenix doesn't do much to affect behavior. That we know. But we can be proactive and get communities involved if we know which cities both experience extreme heat and have the least capacity to deal with it. And by understanding the distribution of those vulnerable populations or those vulnerabilities, we can focus much-needed resources and actually have an impact and save lives. This is a map of heat-related medical incidents throughout Metro Phoenix, and a temporal analysis of this with weather patterns using such variables as nighttime minimum temperature, comfort index, etc., can really help us understand in a given set of parameters where resources need to be targeted, which neighborhoods have a high prevalence of apartment buildings with a with residents, elderly residents on the top floor, or prevalence of air conditioning versus swamp coolers in these areas. So this type of approach of vulnerability mapping is, we see, a fundamental tool that localities can use in responding to the effects that climate change will enhance. Now, climate change is global, we understand that, but all action must be from a local standpoint, because the vulnerabilities are all local. This is another map that colleagues at King's College London developed, and instead of looking at features, thermal characteristics of the city, they developed a sensitivity index based upon a number of different variables: high age, pre-existing illness, people living in communal establishments, population density, index of multiple deprivation. And these are just this is another example of the way in which we can map or locate vulnerability throughout a large urban area to help guide response efforts. Okay. Communicating the health effects of climate change and affecting behavior change is a core challenge. Affecting behavior change through communication is a core challenge of just about any public health program, and climate change is no exception. We need to be careful in the way we frame the question. I'm sure Dr. Maybach will be discussing this much further, but we want to make sure that we empower people and we reduce vulnerabilities to these health impacts through a message that guides their effort to protect their life. This is not the message that we need to be engaging folks with. We don't want to paralyze people with old models of communication and have them cower in their houses. We want to engage people and to empower them with messages that that help them save their lives. One startling, this is probably would count in the anecdotal category, but I guess this was about a year ago, a poll done by the Washington Post, I believe it was showed that 3/4 of 11 to 14-year-olds worry about climate change. This is compared to 41% who are worried about going out with somebody. Now that right there, I mean, it's not probably a valid scientific study, but it gives you some indication of the effect climate change and these prognoses for a changing planet, the impact that it can have on children, adolescents, and even adults who are, you know, likely to be paralyzed by these messages and feel despondent and unable to respond to that or meet the challenge. So we need to move folks away from fearing this to engaging them in responding to it and perhaps moving priorities forward. This is an example of a product that we're developing for heat wave responses. This is a health warning during a heat wave. But we're also developing messages for midterm messaging for heat waves, such as the beginning of summer, and also long-term options for raising the awareness that heat waves actually do kill people. There's a large lack of understanding that heat waves are deadly. People don't take it seriously, both as they engage in strenuous exercise during hot weather, as well as the elderly who feel they can ride out a heat wave in their apartment. And at the third day, they become altered mental. They have altered mental status, and they succumb to it. These are the types of behaviors we can affect people early on. We can decrease the amount of deaths associated with events like this. Another priority health action that public health needs to engage in, and this comes back to the action has to be local category, is that partnerships must be developed between government agencies and private sectors, non-governmental organizations, faith-based organizations, universities, and international organizations to try to bring different perspectives to play on those folks who make decisions or can empower their communities. Faith-based organizations are an interesting group that we have been learning to or understanding the resources, the tremendous resources they have available in their communities, both domestic and internationally, and the amount of influence that these types of groups can have to empower action and to develop community resiliency. And those types of partnerships are critical to any success. This cannot be a top-down approach. It has to be integrative and interactive. Certainly, providing technical advice and support to developing response plans is a key public health role. Not our constituents or our clients are not just public health professionals, but are, in many cases, emergency response personnel, et cetera. And one example of this is our efforts with EPA and FEMA and NOAA to develop excessive heat events guidebooks. And our target audience for this is city responders, people who are responsible for responding to all sorts of natural disasters. And we developed this guidebook, which has a wide variety of options for cities to both understand the risk of heat waves as well as activities that they need to be engaged in both prior to an event and during an event, and including options for defining what exactly an excessive heat event is for a specific locale. It certainly is not the same in Phoenix as it is in Boston. And how to assess local vulnerability. And so these types of technical documents are critical for local response personnel to have at their ready given a specific event, and they know what they can draw on. So this expertise needs to be codified in a better manner. A workforce development is certainly a key a component of this, and certain models such as the TEFINET or EIS programs can train a cadre of environmental and non-environmental, I guess, public health experts who understand integrative thinking, ecosystems thinking, and can be the future workforce that will respond to the health effects of climate change. Many of you have seen this. This is the essential public health functions, the wheel chart, and much of what I said maps directly onto this core functions of public health. And this is pretty much the framework that we're adopting. And that includes assessing the challenge to public health of climate change, and by assessing the health status by tracking diseases and trends related to climate change, investigating outbreaks and understanding their relation to environmental change, communicating effectively on climate change, partnering with private sector organizations, NGOs, etc., developing policies and procedures that localities can use to respond to specific events, assuring a competent workforce that is prepared to respond, and to study the links between climate and health. And all of these areas within public health require substantial reinforcement to respond to the health effects of climate change, because climate change will act as a general stressor on the public health infrastructure. To conclude, I think I have a minute, I think we've reached the point where climate change is a mainstream issue. We are not engaged in a debate over whether it's real or not anymore. It's time to engage it fully as a credible threat to our society. Climate change is and should be framed as a public health issue, and the opportunity costs of not taking action at this point are incredibly high. We have been sitting on the sidelines far too long, and we believe that it's ample time to engage these debates. But luckily, there are effective science-based activities and messages that public health can deliver to respond to these health effects. We're well situated to deal with the health effects of climate change, and over the next few years, it'd be interesting to see how well we engage this topic and rise to the challenge. Thank you. Okay. I guess we can take some questions now before Ed's turn. The question was whether I mentioned that public health has not been engaged or had a seat at the table when with regards to the climate change community, and this includes the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and the U.S. community, the Climate Change Science Program. My experience, the Europeans are far ahead of us on engaging climate change as a public health issue. Now, that is an opinion. I don't even want to venture a guess as to why, but suffice it to say that there are very few public health people on the climate change science program in the United States, and much of even the work group that I sit on, which is the Human Contributions and Responses, I'm the only public health person on that community, and I think many of the other members from DOE or other agencies are excited to have public health people on board and to center this dialogue in that sense.